Moncrief on News Talk.
The environmental journalist John Gibbons grew up on a farm, something he points out in his new book, The Lie of the Land. But he also points out that what the agri-food sector in its current form is costing us. It accounts for about 7% of our gross national income, but 38% of our greenhouse emissions. John, good afternoon to you.
Thanks very much for having me, Sean.
I should point out that the book covers more than just the agri-food sector. There's several of them, but there's a fairly sizable chunk of it, I think that's fair to say. Just in general terms, our target to reduce emissions, I mean nationally, 51% by 2030, what's it likely to be?
Well, the last estimate, Sean, from the EPA, a year ago they said 29% if we do everything right. This year they revised that estimate downwards to 23%. To be honest with you, that 23% is dreamland. Talking to experts in the field, they say that on our current trajectory, it'll be less than half of that. So we might be talking about 10% against a national target of 51%. So we are so far off target here. It's almost off the charts.
What things are we not doing or not doing correctly?
Yeah, I mean, we'll start, I guess, with the big one. Agriculture accounting for about 2/5 of our total national emissions. They were given the softest target of a 25% emissions reduction by 2030, which is way below everybody else. And again, they're trailing in way behind that. Depending on how you calculate it, I reckon we might either have a 1% reduction in agricultural emissions by 2030 or none at all. Right, that's where we're at.
Dairy emissions, are they going up or down?
Well, they've gone up steadily. In fact, they've gone up rapidly since about 2015, 2014, 2015, when we removed the milk quotas.
Yeah.
We've added about 500,000 dairy cows to the national herd, as it's called. And we've seen that has had the effect. They're such prolific methane producers that it's had the effect of driving up emissions across the entire agricultural sector. And it is a thing to bear in mind that livestock is by far and away the largest greenhouse gas emission source from agriculture. So when we say agricultural emissions, you know, there'll be some tillage farmers out there, you know, taking great umbrage and saying, well, why are you including us in that? Because there are forms of farming that are nature friendly and that are environment and climate friendly. Unfortunately, the ones that we specialise in are neither.
Yeah. Now, there is this thing that you do write about, the Origin Green certificate. Explain what that is.
Sure. Well, of course, Origin Green is something that was dreamed up by the marketing people over in Bordbia. That's the state food marketing agency, which has its roots, I should add, in the beef marketing board. So its DNA is very much livestock. They've used a lot of taxpayers' money over the years to sell this idea of Origin Green. They use, for example, very, very expensive videos featuring Saoirse Ronan walking through a verdant field of green, telling us essentially that, you know, Ireland has always been green and we're just really good at this stuff. And of course, what we tend to be really, really good at is greenwash. I mean, the environmental indicators do not support the notion that we are particularly good or green in any regard in our agricultural methods. In fact, there's one particular EU measure that I could use, which says that if you took for every euro of agricultural output in the EU, Ireland produces more greenhouse gas emissions per euro of food output than any other country in the EU27. Now, how's that for green?
Mm. So Origin Green was a kind of a scheme to kind of where farms could be certified and they'd have to fill a set of criteria.
Yeah, within Origin Green, there are different schemes, for example, where people can be certified on their greenness. Now, I've had various communications, let's say, with Bordbia to look at this. And the initial thing is essentially pretty much everybody who applied for it. I think I mentioned the figure of about 99.5% of the farmers who applied got the certification. I went back in the course of writing and researching the book last year and kind of repeated the question. In fact, earlier this year, repeated the question, so how are we doing? And what they were able to tell me is that about 2/3 of the farmers who were on this scheme were in major non-compliance with the scheme. Now, right, 2/3, right, as opposed to 99%. So I think we're you know, to my mind, and maybe this is a little harsh, but we really need to set, you know, rigorous criteria. And the problem with all of this is that Irish public isn't buying it, right? Rather, we should be treating our agri-food sector as a, you know, a national asset and championing its greenness. But what we're doing instead is selling the idea that is not backed by data, that is not scientifically supported. And the problem with that is it undermines the whole argument. And what I'm really, part of my pitch here is let's be honest about it. Let's cut out the marketing spiel and let's look at the data, and then let's build our agriculture sector around the needs, particularly needs, Sean, like food security. This is a real, an issue I think that is poorly understood in Ireland. We keep hearing from our politicians and our policymakers that we're this great food island that is feeding 40 million people. I've no doubt you've heard that line. The reality is that when you break it down to what are called net food calories, so that's when the whole thing is worked out together, Ireland is in fact a net food energy importer, which is incredible, to the tune, by the way, of the entire food requirements for about 2.5 million people. So, yeah. So while, yes, we export about 90% of our beef and dairy, we do not export it, by the way, to feed the world's poor. This is another concept that is that we're part of solving the problem of world hunger. I've heard this from representative organizations over and over again. About 1% of Irish beef and dairy exports go to developing countries. The rest are luxury items sold to luxury countries. And in a sense, the hit that is taken for this overproduction of particularly these ruminant products, as in beef and dairy specifically, the hit, the environmental hit, the damage to our waterways, the spiralling carbon pollution, that hit is absorbed right here in Ireland by the Irish taxpayer. We know, for example, we're facing EU fines of between 8 and 26 billion, that's with a B, coming down the line by 2030. And the lion's share of that, again, we're looking at the largest single contributor to that is agriculture, and specifically livestock agriculture. And you've got to ask the question, why would the regular taxpayer in the proverbial two up, two down be paying for this? Because there are people making a lot of money out of this. Let's be clear. Of course there are. There's a certain number of people making a lot of money, but they're making that money because they're not paying for the downsides of this rapid expansion and for the fact that they're taking us as a nation in the wrong direction. And exposing every taxpayer in Ireland is hugely exposed to the enormous costs that are coming down the line on this.
Who's making the money? Because I'm sure there are farmers listening in right now who are struggling, saying it's not me that's making the money. Who's making the money?
Okay, you're absolutely right. It's very much broken down into different parts. We find, for example, that the average beef farmer in Ireland would, without the input of subsidies, would be underwater. In other words, they would be insolvent were it not for subsidies. So the beef farmers are struggling, no question about that. Dairy farmers are doing absolutely great. I think the average income for 2025 is on track to be over €100,000 per dairy farmer. And I'm not talking about gross income, I'm talking about net income. So these are hugely profitable operations. And by the way, that's an average figure. Some of them are multiples of that. And of course, this dairy boom has allowed those more successful expansionary dairy farmers to buy out and leasing, for example. You hear tillage farmers saying that they can no longer afford to lease land because the dairy farmers are gobbling it up. And what we're turning Ireland into essentially is a monocultural island of ryegrass. As far as the eye can see, Sean, in every direction, ryegrass. You convert that into milk and into beef, and then you sell it off to international markets. As a system of food production, it is insanely unproductive. If you took
anyone in the agri-food centre, when quotas disappeared, was it addressed at all about limiting the size of the national herd, as it's called?
No, not really. It was considered a free-for-all. I remember one of the guys from, I think it was Rabobank, saying that it was like, he said the atmosphere back in 2015, he said it was like the night before Christmas. It was a febrile atmosphere. It was like, just get in. And the view was, look, we're going to make a ton of money here, right? Well, so some of us are going to make a ton of money. As I say, very few beef farmers are making money. No sheep farmers are making money. Almost no tillage farmers are making money. So we've got a small cohort of farmers making a huge amount of money, contributing a vastly disproportionate amount of pollution and contributing to our declining water quality. But they're getting a free ride because at the moment, there's no levies and no taxes. It has been proposed, for example, the OECD suggested that we need to have carbon taxes on high emissions food sources. But of course, that's been rejected in Ireland.
Yeah. Also, you mentioned water there. Nitrogen in water How significant or not a problem is that?
It's hugely significant. Nitrogen in Ireland accounts, it's the number one water pollutant in Ireland. And again, agriculture and specifically livestock agriculture, the runoff from it. So nitrogen gets into our waterways, Sean, in two different routes. One is when we apply chemical nitrogen to the soil. Because, of course, as you know, in Ireland, it rains a lot. So much of that gets washed directly into our waterways. That's number one. The second, of course, is cattle. The nitrogen causes the grass to grow. The cattle eat the grass. Because it's so nitrogen rich, most of the nitrogen that they eat gets excreted back in their urine. Sorry to be introducing that on a Monday afternoon. And that urine, those so-called urine patches, are nitrogen rich. And they again find their way back into the waterways because we are simply dumping far too much nitrogen. And remember, we're breaking the nitrogen cycle here. Rather than the traditional farming, the farming system that I grew up in was one where, you know, there was limited inputs of external, say, energy like chemical nitrogen, like pesticides and so on, and fertilizers. You used animal manures sparingly. Now, with cheap imported fertilizers, and for example, we don't charge any taxes, any VAT on fertilizers. That's another recommendation that has been ignored in Ireland. If we did, we might use them more sparingly. I think the problem again in Ireland is fertilizers are too cheap and they're overused and they're ending up in our waterways. Mm. And nitrogen is a potent pollutant. I'm sure you've seen what's happened in Loch Ness.
And there's implications for human health.
There certainly is. Nitrogen is dangerous for humans. Excess nitrogen levels are associated with increased cancers. So we do not want nitrogen in our waterways. And once it's in, by the way, it's extremely difficult and expensive to get it out again. And this is important to say, again, if a factory were doing this, there would be a public furore. There would be protests outside the factory. But because it's happening in this dispersed way up and down the countryside, then there's so little sort of pushback on it. But I do think we should be vastly more concerned about nitrogen pollution.
OK, let me read you out a few texts. As you can imagine, some people aren't agreeing with you. So we are worried about cow farts, and the Chinese just finished building 5 coal-powered electrical substations. Pieces of meat has gone through the roof because the national herd is smaller. Says the texter.
Yeah. Well, first of all, sorry to correct your texter. It's actually burps, not farts.
Yeah.
Just to be pedantic.
All right.
And we can always play the game about what about China. It's a game that gets us nowhere. Irish emissions per capita are far, far higher than China. And by the way, many of the Chinese emissions are accounted for in China, but they actually relate to goods that end up being exported to high consumption countries like Ireland.
Mm.
So we get no free pass for China.
The usual ill-informed anti-farming rant, that guy is using 2015 as his baseline. The reality is that there is a global demand for dairy and beef products. They can be produced in the lowest carbon footprint countries like Ireland and New Zealand or South America at the highest carbon footprint. It's that simple. We produce food for 40 million people, so the net importer's argument doesn't add up.
Well, I'm afraid your texter missed the earlier part of the programme. As I say, these myths have been spun and we hear all manner of malarkey about how efficient we are and so on and so forth. And if that's the case, by the way, that about this great global demand, why are we giving Bordbia millions of euros of taxpayers' money to go abroad to persuade them to buy Irish beef and dairy products? Because apparently, according to your texter, this stuff is flying off the shelves.
Mm. Let's not forget that if we switch to pure tillage, there will be less insects and wildlife and more pesticides and herbicides. We need a much broader approach to the environment. Only 11% forests and 2% old type forests, is the texter.
Mm. Yeah, what's missing from our agricultural system is balance. We have an overloaded system with livestock. That's the issue. I'm not saying we shouldn't have a livestock sector. Of course we should. It should be balanced. And I make the point, for example, that Ireland, our horticulture is a fantastically efficient way of producing food for human consumption. And I use the analogy of Holland, for example. About 40% of the land area of Ireland, they produce 7 times more food than Ireland. Why? Because they're not producing grass. And you'll notice humans are not really crazy about eating grass. We're not really designed to digest it. So we devote millions of hectares to growing grass to convert into beef and dairy products. And that's an incredibly wasteful process. If you simply grow food directly, and this is the part of the message that's got forgotten in Ireland. We used to do this. We used to do this. We used to produce lots of horticulture, lots of vegetable root crops and so on, and cereals.
And things like carrots and broccoli. The producers of those are down to single figures now.
That's right, Sean. And how's this for a start? Last year, Ireland imported about 1 million tons of vegetables, fruit and vegetables last year. A million tons. We're importing stuff that grows brilliantly in Ireland. For example, we imported 75,000 tons of potatoes, for goodness sakes, right? Again, we have a system that is designed for this. I'll tell you who it's really working for. I mean, we talk about farmers, but to be honest, the silent group behind this who don't tend to make as much noise, it's the agribusiness PLCs, the multi-billion euro organizations. What they want out of Irish agriculture is cheap commodities to feed into their factories to turn into products for export. And that's what I'm trying to challenge, among other things in the book. And I think you're correct in saying, Sean, that I think of the 9 chapters, 3 of them relate to agriculture and agribusiness, but we've also taken a long look at energy, at housing, and indeed at the media, how we're doing in that regard. So what I wanted really with this book was to sort of give a broad survey. Where are we in Ireland in the mid-2020s? How did we get here? And most importantly, how can we do better? Because
on the point of energy generation, and you know, we're surrounded by windy coasts, you'd think we'd be doing gangbusters from this. We're not at the moment, excuse me. I was interested to read about, even if you're planning for an offshore wind farm, laying the cables, that's a very, very specialised area.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if you want to develop offshore wind, first of all, the actual structures, the turbines inside, these are huge. And I made the point, for example, that the only port on the island of Ireland capable of handling these large offshore wind turbines is actually in Belfast. We need to upgrade our ports in the Republic so that we can do it here. And there's a huge opportunity here. There's no question. The big opportunity for Ireland in the certainly into the 2030s, is to become a net exporter of offshore wind energy. We have some of the best continuous wind speeds in certainly in Europe and even in the world. So if there's one thing that we should be really, really good at, it is offshore wind production. We're adding, for example, cables to allow us to bring that energy directly to Britain and indeed to France. We'll open our first direct link to the European Union, I think, in 2027. And that means that you can overproduce, vastly overproduce electrical energy using offshore wind in particular, and then sell that, connect that to the European grid. We sell our surpluses when we have it, and then we buy back surplus when we need it. But part of the transition, Sean, is we need to electrify everything. We need to take our energy system, our home heating system, our transport system, and electrify it. Now, when I say electrified, I don't mean biofuels. I don't mean all of these, you know, wishy-washy half measures. I mean electrification, from heat pumps in our homes to electric vehicles to electrifying public transport. We have the opportunity, and I made the point that we've done it before. A century ago, the Irish government took a quarter of its entire budget and said, we are going to build out Ardna Crusha. And they did it in 4 years. We need that type of Marshall Plan thinking again, brave political thinking, rising to the crisis. And by golly, in 2025, Sean, we're in a crisis.
I don't know how close or far we are from having offshore wind farms of any considerable size there. But there are these ships that lay these cables, and you have to book them a decade in advance.
That's right. Part of the challenge is, as I said, apart from the having the ports that can handle them, there's the cable laying ships, and they all have to be booked in. And what the people developing these are looking for more than anything from the state is certainty. We've had, for example, very chaotic offshore licensing, where you know you might have the foreshore requiring one license, offshore another license, and then you've got more licensing once you bring the cables on shore. So there's a group, there's an organization called MARA, which is our Marine Area organization that has was set up in 2023, I believe, and its purpose is to consolidate all this so that we have a one-stop shop that allows a simplification and a clarification of the planning involved. And I would say as well, we, the public, need to get behind this. I've been at various public meetings where people inexplicably explain that the idea of a turbine 10 or 12 kilometres off the coastline makes them feel ill, and they think it's a terrible intrusion on their life. I think in the teeth of a climate crisis, and we probably haven't touched on that yet, Sean, why do we need to do all these things? Why can't we just do things the way we've always done them? And that is because we are in the depths of a growing climate crisis. I was speaking to somebody earlier who's based in Portugal, and she was making the point that the climate crisis is hitting them directly, full blast in the face. Mm. They're parts of the country, many parts of Europe, are moving quickly towards being dangerously overheated and heading towards, unless we turn this off, unless we stop burning fossil fuels at the rate and ejecting carbon, Sean, at the rate of 50 billion tons a year, right? If unless we dial that back, we're heading to a future, a near future of large areas, including here in Europe, that are abandoned, uninhabitable, forcing countless millions of people to migrate. And where are they going to go?
An awful lot of the texts are coming in are kind of in the, and I think I read one out that was kind of similar, the kind of whataboutery texts in that we can't make a difference. Why should we? Where, you know, someone says they just flew back from the US, they were in the city of Houston, has the same amount of carbon footprint as the whole country of Ireland. So no matter what we do, it's not going to make any difference at all. Also, those fines that are coming down the line, they will go away by the time we get there. They will have changed the laws. We won't have to pay them. It's pure scaremongering.
Yeah, and I'm afraid that's pure dreamland. Again, we're back to whataboutery. Right, Ireland has punched, as a nation, way above its weight. We're 5 million people, and nobody would say that even though we're in the European Union, which is 450 million people, we have played diplomatically, politically, we've punched far above our weight. So what we do here matters. The kind of cynicism that you're hearing there, the kind of, oh, why bother stuff.
It's kind of fatalism. Oh,
and
really?
Actually, fatalism is a better word for it. That type of attitude is what got us into this mess in the first place. We can be, should be, and must be an exemplar, Sean, for best practice. And what happens then is other countries say, my God, look at the Irish, they got their act together. And by the way, the strange thing about strong climate action is that mostly it makes stuff better. What do we get out of it, Sean? We get better water quality. We get better air. We get quieter, friendlier cities. We get kids that are cycling to school and less problem with obesity. We get happier, healthier society. So, you know, so often the climate challenge is framed as this thing that these people are trying to make us take away the fun out of life. Quite the opposite. What we're trying to do, in fact, is to rebalance the overconsumption, and much of it, by the way, hasn't made us happier. Our net happiness isn't going up with all this consumption. It's going down. And we're seeing that time and time again. So I think, to go back to it, I think Ireland has the opportunity. We have the tools here. And we're a stable, democratic, well-educated society. We're the perfect society to build this out. And we're also a scale where we can do the right stuff and then say to other countries, well, now, you follow us. But this kind of hat-hanging defeatism and foot-dragging stuff, you know, it really, where does it get us? And all it gets us is nowhere.
Given what so much of what you've written in the book, and particularly about the greenwashing, particularly government ministers who turn two faces, two directions at the same time, do you think we really are going to do any of this?
I think we have to. We've got no choice. If we don't grasp this, we're looking at, you know, widespread societal breakdown, whether it starts here or whether it starts elsewhere and spreads here. You know, what we call this version of civilization is hanging by a thread. So what keeps me focused, and the reason why, you know, The Lie of the Land was written, is to give an honest account to say, where are we really? How do we get here? And how can we get out of this mess? I don't have all the answers, by the way, just some. And how can we build a climate resilient, energy secure, and food secure island, where we're able to provide for ourselves, we're able to export a modest surplus, and we have a healthy, thriving population. We repopulate rural Ireland, by the way, because the type of farming that we described earlier is actually emptying rural Ireland of people, filling it with cattle, emptying it of people. We want that. We also want to have a planning system that allows us to reinvigorate, for example, our towns and villages. They have been hollowed out, Sean, by the sort of suburbanization of rural Ireland, which is very popular with certain rural TDs, but it's bad for carbon, it's bad for social isolation, and it's bad to have to put Johnny in the back of the car every time you want to get a pint of milk or bring him to a GAA match. You know, they're the kind of areas where we've really come up short. And I think we've done it because our politicians have really just failed to hold the line. They have bowed to populist pressure time and time again. And I take an optimistic slant on all this, by the way. I think we can do better as a country.
John, thanks so many for coming in to us today. That was John Gibbons there. The name of that book is The Lie of the Land.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 p.m. on News Talk.